590 The Fan.
Fan Morning Show, Sports at 590 The Fan. Happy Friday. We're going to be joined by someone you might remember from a week ago. Was a part of this trio. He spent time with us. He cared about us. No longer does he respond to our text messages. No longer does he check in.
Yo, Ailish, you're gonna be a great mom, huh? Like, you're gonna be just like not guilty. You're not bringing that like Eastern European
guilt chirping him into
a mom at all. Hey, like, doesn't text me anymore, thinks he's too good. It's like he gets a job and you're like just slashing his tires. Your kids
now,
never,
we're proud of our guy.
Your
Blake
kids
Murphy.
Living at home. Your kids living at home till he's till you die. You know, like, oh, you're never, like, that's how long your kids live. What's up, Blake? How are we doing?
Doing well. Nice to finally get an NBA playoff game that was worth the title of NBA playoff game.
Thank you for that, NBA. Thank you.
Oh, I thought you were thanking me. You're welcome. No. You're welcome. I called Jason Tatum beforehand. I called Steph Curry. I was like, look, we haven't had a lot of good basketball chat on the morning show lately. Get it done, guys. Mm-hmm.
So I will admit something. I get nostalgic for the NBA Finals more than anything else. Like, both my parents are basketball coaches. I grew up with a lot of NBA history just in my house because both my parents were Boston Celtics fans. My mom is a basketball coach. Like, I have a championship basketball behind me that's signed by the 86 Celtics because my mom met that team with her women's basketball team, went down to Seattle, met the team, got the ball signed. My mom, just like, you know, pioneer-ish women's basketball coach. What's up?
Sorry, this is a bit of a tangent. Is your mom, like, still actively into basketball and, like, watching the series rooting for the Celtics?
Well, here's the thing. My mom has become a hardcore Raptors fan. So she has no, like, her affinity to the Celtics has completely diminished because she's
opposite of my mom, who's Golden State Warriors till the day she dies.
But that's why I asked. We had a little mom battle.
We could have had a little rivalry. Too bad.
No, but my dad was a Celtics fan for sure. And so, like, I do find myself, it's weird because my uncle had season's tickets to the Golden State Warriors, and anytime we would get to visit him, we'd go see the Warriors. And I grew up like kind of having a secondary rooting interest in, like, I'm the only person who thinks Mitch Richmond belonged in the Basketball Hall of Fame. I'm like, that's correct. Like, yeah,
no,
like,
I think he belonged in the Hall of Fame because it lowers the bar for certain players that I might want in the Hall of Fame.
Yeah, but
like Al Horford.
Like the NBA Finals is especially special to me because it's almost always the best teams. Like, it's who actually belongs there. So often, I love the Stanley Cup Finals. The Stanley Cup playoffs are phenomenal, except for a lot of the times you don't have the best teams in it. You go, oh, the Dallas Stars are here, the Montreal Canadiens are here. It's a lot of that throughout the history. Oftentimes there are great matchups, but it's not a guarantee. The Super Bowl is usually closer to the NBA Finals, but I don't feel the same emotional connection to football as I do basketball and the history of basketball versus football to me. Like, they're just not there. World Series, similar thing, except for World Series, you're, for most of your life, I don't know anyway, I felt always so bitter, like, we can never have the money to get here, you know, like, that was it.
And then when you did have the money, a team with no good players wins the World Series, the Kansas City Royals. Like, like, baseball is closer to hockey than it is basketball in terms of do the best teams make it all the way and are the two best teams in the finals. And obviously it's, you know, the Yankees dynasty years, the Dodgers of late, usually those teams at least make a good run, but there's not that same sense of finality where, like, I don't think there's a team in the NBA playoffs this year that can be sitting at home right now and doing the, well, we should be there thing. There's not.
Milwaukee. That's the only ones because of Middleton's injury. But I still feel like Boston was the Eastern team of the year. Yep. Yeah. And I still think that Boston was the team of the year. And they've had multiple injuries. They had Marcus Smart out a bunch of games. Time Lord came into the playoffs hurt. They had,
and he's still
like,
clearly
a lot
banged up.
Yeah, he is. He's not himself. Either way, I love both these teams. The story of this too, like, the Golden State Warriors at the closer to the end of their run, trying to hold on to their dominance after a 3-year finals absence, returning and trying to capture it versus a plucky upstart team, one of the better defensive teams that arguably we've ever seen in NBA history, from a classic franchise, two classic franchises, right? Like the team that Rick Barry played for, that the versus the Boston Celtics, that it's the Bay Area versus Boston, that it's still in a way California versus Boston. I adore this matchup. The jerseys, the fan bases, everything about it gets me deep in the feels. Like, I get emotional watching these games. Every time I see Bill Russell kicking around, I go like, oh, come on, this is going to be amazing. And last night just delivered in every possible way. And I'm almost overwhelmed by it. Like, I was joking, Blake, with Ailish after how I couldn't get to sleep after that game for like 2 hours because I was just buzzing with excitement. Like, I'm like calling my brother to talk to him about the game a little bit more and just going over a bunch of things. So, yes, this is going to be a very excited basketball block. But, yeah, basketball hits differently that way when you get these classic matchups and when you get the history back. And I don't know. I get, if you're somebody who watched the Showtime show on HBO, it's like a bit of a stretch, but that's probably the introductory to a lot of people to like Lakers Celtics. Celtics are obviously villainous figures in this show. Like Red Auerbach, they portray him as the worst. Larry Bird, they portray him as the worst. Everybody, right? Poor Kevin McHale gets no mentions. But anyway, it's a phenomenal series, and it's going to be really great. And to get that, like, if this goes, I would say this. You've watched a lot of basketball games. I don't know if they still do NBA Hardwood Classics. Used to love watching those on a casual, like, afternoon day, throw on some NBA TV.
They put the Kobe 81-point game on all the time. It was on, like, once a week when they would do that.
Yeah, but I loved when that would be on because then I would actually watch it because I missed it live. I was sour. That was my year of being sour at the losing the Sonics because they had been sold. And so I boycotted the NBA, and I missed that game. And it's an all-time regret moment for me because, your roommate wakes you up and tells you how many points did Kobe score last night, and you guess 60, and he keeps doing the thumb-up move and kept going over 65, 70, 75, 80, and like, yeah. Really wish I saw it. But anyway, did we see a true classic last night?
I think so. And I think Steph Curry sets the tone right away, right? Sets a record for most threes in an opening quarter in a finals game, has 21 points in the first quarter. And then Boston hangs around long enough that you're like, okay, we're going to get a good close at least. And then it ended up being a 17-0 run at one point. Mm-hmm. Like, that is, in any game, a pretty remarkable comeback against a team like the Golden State Warriors. But you break it down into the component parts where, yeah, you took Steph Curry's best first punch and kept going through. You tiptoed around a pretty good Wiggins game. I know a lot of guys didn't support, there wasn't a lot of secondary scoring in that game for Golden State, which is kind of what Boston does to you. But Wiggins had a good game. And then Jason Tatum was phenomenal in general, but he shot 3 of 17. So for you to survive all of those things and come up with that comeback win, I mean, like, obviously it was a great game anyway, but if you're the Boston Celtics, that is, you're going back past the big three era for the last time you felt that good about a finals win, I think. Like, that was one of the most impressive fourth quarters I could ever remember seeing from a team.
It was one of those things where, as it was happening, because I'll admit that I'm watching the game, and now it's starting to get later in the night, and the game is looking like the Warriors have just closed this thing out. And my viewing isn't passive, but it's like now I'm doing like phone checks. I'm kind of texting with people. I'm looking at some of my other bets from the evening. I'm looking at my horrific beat of my worst beat so far of the year. I'm kind of paying attention. And like all of a sudden the Celtics start to pour it in. And like you and I actually were texting about White, right?
Derek
like
White,
we're sending each other texts a little bit, and I'm going, okay, but this isn't really going to happen. And part of it is that we've seen the Golden State Warriors in the past, and no one's doing that to the Golden State Warriors in a finals matchup. Like, no one's. I know that they're almost like Steph Curry's Warriors are almost most famous for a team coming back on them in 2016, but not like this. Like, this is not happening. The threes just start pouring in. They hit everything from everywhere. The degree of difficulty on some of those shots that they were making and just like the frequency in which they were going in. It was just like it. we use the term shell-shocked. That's exactly what that was. They just shell-shocked the Golden State Warriors with three-point shooting, like a barrage of three-point shooting from Al Horford and from Derek White. And I've never seen a champion like that just look so completely overwhelmed and stunned. Golden State fell apart. Like, there was still time left in that basketball game. And yet, with, like, over 2 minutes left, it was over. It was over, despite it still being in the single digits.
It was. And you had Draymond foul out, and you had, you know, a number of things that just, like, this isn't the Warriors. What are you doing here? Mm. And I know Draymond only fouled out with a minute left, and they were already up 14. But, like, yep. He was clearly, while the game was still close, not defending like Draymond, worried about getting fouled out. And, again, like, they didn't have the secondary scoring around Steph in this one, which, you know, we've kind of wondered if it would be a problem all year at some point, because Klay still doesn't look like Klay. Wiggins has had this awesome season, but he's a secondary scorer. And then your guys like Draymond, Looney, you know, Iguodala being back in the lineup is great for them defensively and to have an extra playmaker. But, like, he kind of just looks like Thad Young at this point, not Andre Iguodala. And I don't mean that to knock Thad Young. I just mean playoff Iguodala historically has gone to another level. It's tough. A lot of stuff went wrong for Golden State. And you mentioned the shooting for Boston, 18 of 28 on threes for the non-Tatum, non-Brown guys. And I think one of the biggest factors in this one is, again, yes, Tatum shot 3 of 17. But as far as wing ball handlers go, that has to be one of the best playmaking performances we've ever seen. And that's Golden State is not the Golden State defense of old, but they're still a team that can lock in and has Draymond Green out there. And Looney's turned into a pretty good defender. At some point, they might have to use Gary Payton Jr., who only has one arm. Because the Celtics got a lot of space from outside and were pretty deadly. You're not going to shoot 18 of 28 on threes again, probably, but you don't have to. You got that win. You move on.
Yeah, well, you're not going to get 3 of 17 from Tatum again either.
Exactly.
So if the Celtics can pull this off, where does Tatum's postseason rank for you? He beats Durant, Giannis, Butler, and then Curry. Like, where does that put him in terms of conversations of people that have been able to propel a team to victory?
It's pretty high, and it's not the first time we've seen this from Tatum. On his way up as a player, like, he had a really good 2018 playoffs at just 19 years old. It's when there were all those memes about, wow, he's doing this and he's only 13. He's only 11 years old. All the announcers would talk about is how young Jason Tatum is. And then you go ahead to the bubble year. He was unbelievable against the Raptors. Even though the shooting efficiency wasn't there every single game, he was awesome. He averaged over 30 points a game in that first round defeat for them last year. And now, yeah, he's putting up monster numbers. And I think the versatility with which he's doing that is huge. Now, it's a hard thing to quantify. And like I even brought up the basketball reference search of, like, okay, best playoffs ever by win shares. And win shares isn't a great metric, especially in a small playoff sample. But I was trying to think, like, oh, how would you, like, get a quick snapshot of these are the best playoff performances ever? Tatum's relies entirely on you have to watch these series. You have to remember who he went through. If they win the title, people will remember that Boston went through all those guys. But it's tough to contextualize it and tough to ask people to remember that if they don't win the ring. Mm-hmm. So if it keeps going this way, yeah, I think Tatum's going to be known as one of those guys. And I had him fifth on my hypothetical MVP ballot this year. I would have had him probably second team all NBA. I think that's for one season. That's descriptive looking back. It's not the same as saying a guy's a top 10 player, but I think the guy's a top 10 player at this point.
Yeah, no, he's a top 10 player. And he's had some really good games. And you're right, Blake. His playmaking yesterday was beyond impressive. Like, he was just throwing some absolute dimes out there. But, like, I don't feel that way, Ailish. I guess that this has been so much a Tatum beating these teams run. Like, that's not how I'm remembering it or how I'm really looking at it. He's had some brilliant games, but he's also had some real downers, too. Like, there have been some real questioning Jason Tatum moments throughout this postseason. And I think that I'm higher maybe on him than top 10. I think that if he wins in the finals, you got to put him into top 5 conversations, because they're not winning unless he's really, really good, unless he's carrying his team in some form offensively. But to me, it's like, this is kind of the next question, is who has the best unit in this series, right? And, like, who has the best unit? And to me, it's unquestionably the Boston Celtics and their defense. The way that they just pass off offensive player to offensive player, like, that their defense can just switch and go 1 through 5, these players, and the versatility in which they can do it from, like, their different bench units that they can have, the different guys that they bring into some of these ball games, it's astonishing to watch it. Like, we've seen some really good defensive Raptors basketball teams here, so I actually do feel as though this market should be able to appreciate it a little bit more than others, because this has been a place that defense has been a hallmark. I'll tell you this right now. Raptors have never had a defensive team like this. And, like, all the talk that there's always been about, hey, the Raptors having built this team where it's, like, around defense, well, it's like, this is the blueprint, is looking at this Celtics team and saying, well, maybe you can win with defense. Daniele and I used to always get so frustrated with the Raptors, saying they need to focus a little bit more on offense. They can't, it's like, even they brought it up during the broadcast, which is true. Good offense meets great defense or whatever. Great offense beats great defense. That's true to an extent. But this defense, like, the way that they just roll 8 guys deep, where you go, damn, every one of these guys is a stud on this end. The way they get to the ball, the way that they contest shots, the way that they can all defend out to the perimeter, it's a just, they're ghastly.
Yeah, I'd argue that the Raptors hit something close to this level of defense during the championship run, but very close. Different stylistically, with, you know, Gasol and Ibaka playing a more conservative scheme, and you're doing more trapping instead of switching when you have your traditional bigs out there. But yeah, in terms of the best unit, who are you more confident in your final five? Well, Boston's 8 rotation players, I'm not counting Daniel Theis, because when you drop under a screen against Steph Curry, I think you get glued to the bench for a series. Yeah. That's Steph Curry, bud. Know your personnel. But the 8 players that they play can all – who did, sorry?
Time Lord. He did it too. Yeah.
Yeah.
But I think that's an injury.
But the 8 guys they're going to rely on heavily in this can all play defense. And Peyton Pritchard's been a little bit of a surprise in that regard, but he was annoying to Steph Curry. He was like – it wasn't quite Fred VanVleet boxing one, but he's a pest when he gets going. And I look at the 8 guys that Boston can play. It's like, okay, there's no one you're targeting on defense. There's no one who breaks up what they do schematically. And then you look at the Golden State side, and it's like, okay, well, Clay's not back to that level defensively yet. Iguodala and Porter are good, but, like, teams don't treat them with the same respect offensively, even though Otto Porter hit 4 threes last night. And the big one is that a lot of Golden State's best lineups this year, and a lot of what people thought this year's version of the Death Star lineup was or whatever, included Jordan Poole, who might be unplayable by the end of this series. Like, he was a turnstile yesterday, and the Celtics are very good at finding those guys. They made Tyler Hero and Duncan Robinson basically unplayable in the last round, and I know there were injury concerns and stuff like that. It wasn't a perfect snapshot, but Jordan Poole looked like a guy who can't be in the series last night, at least not to the tune of 25 minutes a game.
I just I think a win like that, if it happens against a team that isn't the Golden State Warriors with a championship pedigree, that can't go into that locker room and have Steve Kerr and Draymond and Steph and Clay, that it actually cooks almost every single team. They are able to probably, I hope anyways, overcome this. But it's that game too now is fascinating from the standpoint of it's a must win for Golden State. Boston has been they say too, defense travels. Well, guess what? That's a really good hallmark for the Boston Celtics, because what have they done all postseason long? They've gone and they've won on the road. Whether it's been game 7 in Miami, whether it's now this game 1 here, whether it's huge wins in Milwaukee. Remember, they were in that series, that game 5, they were heading to Milwaukee for a massive one, and they end up turning around the series after, you know, Giannis and Drew Holiday steal one and put the series in a really difficult spot for Boston. I really love both these teams, but there's something different about Boston. And yeah, the reason why I compare it to the Raptors is because, again, the Raptors did have a team that was close. And so to see a group in the modern day that I think is, like, pretty unequivocally better than what we saw in 2019, it's almost shocking to me. Like, it's almost shocking that we're seeing a group with a higher level or a higher ceiling. And yeah, there's just so many plays where Marcus Smart, I think that's actually the difference between the two, is that you look at Lowry versus Smart, where the two guys were at defensively, especially given Lowry's age and where he was at that. There's just nothing that you can attack with Boston. Like, I don't know where you're supposed to feel good when you have a possession. Like, what the matchup is. What do you think the matchup is that you're saying, if you're Golden State, this is the matchup that we're looking for, hunting for? It's not even about that.
No, and I think last night they thought maybe it was Peyton Pritchard, and he hung in well enough that, look, you have to hunt someone, and I think they're still probably going to hunt that, but he was good enough, and that's all you need to be game to game. I know.
Yeah.
So yeah, I don't like. There's certainly no one in their starting five. Like,
yeah,
that's it's one of those things where, and one of the lessons I'm taking away from this one is, and this is true of both teams, but especially with Boston because of how good they are defensively. Like, this is a team that doesn't play anyone bigger than 6'9" or 6'10". Also, and this is a good example of, hey, how can you scale that to championship level? It's not necessarily saying that the Raptors are going to be Boston or anything like that, but this is a team that doesn't have that traditional 7-footer, and the one they do have in Daniel Theis probably isn't going to play much. And he's only 6'9" too. He's just really bulky, so you think of him as a traditional center. So if I'm the Raptors, I'm watching this one pretty closely on both sides. And yeah, what Boston's doing defensively, especially how Horford and Williams fit together defensively, because that's kind of like a dual center thing. Like, Horford's not really a center, but he's played at center. It's very interesting when you have a team full of 6'9" guys with length to see Horford and Williams defending together at this level.
You're right.
I got the notebook out.
Well, there is something to be said about, hey, there's the parallel to what the Raptors are trying to do with the size. I would say that Robert Williams, like, he's arguably DPOY level player. That was the thing.
Yeah.
And Al Horford, same thing, where there's not too many veterans who have that ability to just play next to a guy like that. And so, yeah, if you're the Raptors and you're looking at this as what's the formula, well, it's, you got to have one of the best defensive players in the NBA at that position doing that in Robert Williams. And then you also have to have Al Horford, who is 6'11". Like, it's not like he's some little short guy.
I mean, they list him at 6'9".
I've seen him listed at multiple things. I guess maybe he's an actual 6'9" because they did the readjustments of heights. But throughout his career, he was always listed as a 6'11" guy. It's a very unique situation what they end up having. Okay, so last one for me, anyways. What's the Steph legacy ceiling here? Do you think that there's actually a real, like, tangible change that could happen? Because I talked to Andrew Bogut yesterday, and I was asking about what a finals MVP meant for Steph, and he went, yeah, obviously he wants it, but I don't think it's that big of a deal. I think it is more for the media. And that's sort of the corner I've always been on, which is, I don't think that Steph needs a finals MVP to be validated for the guy that he is. However, I did get the feeling that the Durant thing is real in the series, because I felt it yesterday. I went, the Warriors wouldn't have blown that game if KD is there. Like, that's just a fact. They don't blow that game, and it feels completely different. I love this finals because it does feel so open. It doesn't feel like it's already concluded before it begins like it has with other Warriors teams. But if Durant is there, then they don't blow that game, and what it's ultimately about is winning championships. And so for Steph Curry, the ability to win one in his 30s, I just think that puts him a little bit closer into the, like, he's never going to be LeBron, and the people who make those comparisons are always going to be kind of really stretching and being very selective in their debates. But I have thought of the importance of this one to Steph in terms of, I don't think he's going to be able to get another one. I think that this is the year, and I do wonder where exactly this takes him in terms of the game's all-time greats, or whether this shifts much at all. Like, I honestly go back and forth, Blake.
I go back and forth a little bit on it too, and the one thing that's hard about it is, like, you spend a lot of time online and you see the arguments against Steph as one of the greatest players of all time. And one of those is like, well, he was never the best player on any of his championship teams, which, first of all, isn't true. Iguodala won the finals MVP because he did an awesome job defending LeBron, but he was not the best player on that team. But yeah, he's 34. He'll be 35 next playoffs. You have to assume that this is getting close to his last chance to be the top guy on a championship team. And I do think that is, you know, I don't think he needs it, but I think it's a pretty good feather in the cap of when you start. Because, like, it's one of those things where if Steph was just like a top 25 player of all time, it doesn't really matter that much. You're like, you're going to be so subjective in that range. But once you get borderline top 10 or 15, that's when you start lining up the resumes, the old book of basketball way, where it's like, okay, I'm going to introduce every guy with an italicized line of titles, MVPs, all-stars, all NBA teams. And then you really start comparing those guys. And yeah, he has 8 all NBA teams. He has 8 all-star games and a couple MVPs, but a finals MVP and a fourth championship goes a long way. And that's not to say Steph needs it. It's just to say Steph's in that echelon of conversation in league history where every little bit of that helps.
I don't think that he needs it. You're right. That's the difficulty with the framework now, is that everything is done with these extremes when we do these conversations. So it's like, yeah, obviously Steph Curry doesn't need it. His impact on basketball and his legacy in terms of being an all-time, at least known player, impactful player on iconic teams is solidified, right? But if he wins this title, a couple things end up happening. One is, I think he gets the mantle of the superstar that you would have wanted to play with the most from the era, from LeBron. I think that that moves towards him, which is a really nice thing to have. Also, he will have the same amount of titles as LeBron. And people will always go, yeah, but tour with KD. And I'll go, yep, okay, but still half as many as LeBron. Can we give him at least three? Can we give him, hey, they get three championships where you don't try to put the asterisks up, essentially? Like, I think having as many chips as LeBron, having the greatest shooter of all time mantle, having one in his 20s and in his 30s with multiple teams, having zero against his name in terms of this is what you would not like about the guy. Like, what's the unlikable thing about Steph?
Like, he's a tiny bit corny.
Yeah, I know. His
he
wife
has a bad goatee.
His wife and him do kind of corny media stuff from time to time. But, like, he's kind of this unassailable superstar. And he can end up not only doing this, but he'll outlast LeBron now, too. Like, his Warriors team should remain competitive, and he'll be able to kind of pad his stats. And by the end of this thing, like, where his points, where his threes, where his assists, where a lot of these things, his wins are going to end up sitting, they're going to be really, really high. And I think that, yeah, retroactively, we're going to look back on this and say, boy, he really is kind of unequivocally into the top 10 with this win. It's the thing with Tatum that we talked about, where if Tatum wins this championship, I don't think that the legacy play is quite there yet when Tatum and Brown are, what, 25 and 24? It's too early in their careers.
You got time.
Yeah, this is more about, well, even if they win, I think that for a historical team like Boston, they will always be in the, like, remembered teams, because we just remember the classic teams that win more. But it's going to be more about how they follow it up and whether or not they can kind of grab the reins as the Eastern Conference team moving forward. For Golden State, it doesn't become the bookend, but it does open up the possibility for, like, five championships, which is now, like, Steph gets the Kobe number. Like, I don't know. I think that this is actually a little bit bigger than I gave it on its surface, because I try to push back naturally to the thing about the finals MVP stuff, because I think that there's a case to be made that he could already have two.
Yeah, absolutely he could. I think that's a reasonable case. And, like, those KD ones are coin flips between them. So I don't know. It's actually the first big one.
It's like LeBron should have won finals MVP if they were just doing, like, it in a loss, but they couldn't because Bill Russell. But then it should have been Steph even over Iguodala, even though at the time I did feel like it was Iguodala. Looking back on it now, I don't feel that way.
Yeah, I'm with you. It was a little bit of overthinking it, I think. Because you made things a little harder for LeBron. It's like the old Raptors having LeBron stoppers. It's like, you made things slightly more difficult as he went to 40 points.
Okay, so with that, it's now time for Something to Chew On, brought to you by Great Canadian Meats.
Yum, yum, yum.
So this is a segment, Blake, that we have very much missed you. Because Blake, we got so used to Blake always doing Something to Chew On that there have been a couple of days that we've gone, oh, right, we have to do this, like, in the very, very morning. I have one, but if you'd like to do one and take your rightful place as the heir of the Something to Chew On, the Chew legacy is really a Blake Murphy legacy.
So I do have a quick one, I don't know how much you guys talked about this, if you guys got to it at 6 a.m., but Hyunjin Ryu hit the IL yesterday. That is not entirely surprising, given he continues to deal with forearm tightness and forearm inflammation and things like that. Big picture, though, the Something to Chew On here is, in 10 of his last 11 starts going back to late last year, he hasn't gone past 80 pitches thrown. Jeremy Beasley's up. That's just to replace an extra bullpen arm to give you nine arms there. Ross Stripling is going to start for the foreseeable future. Mm-hmm. He gets a nice soft landing spot Monday against a terrible Royals team on the road. And then, you know, the schedule's pretty soft the next little bit anyway. But my Something to Chew On for you guys is, if and when Ryu comes back, are you planning out the rest of your season, given that, again, 10 of his last 11 starts, he hasn't gone past 80 innings? Is he like a glorified opener where you have to get more conservative with how you've used Stripling as a bullpen arm Like, he came in to replace Romano the other weekend. He's getting random innings here and there. When Ryu's back, do you have to treat this as a pure piggyback slash opener follower? Because, look, Ryu's probably not getting into the fifth very often.
Yeah, JD's been steadfast on this actually this week, saying that he likes them as a tandem, and I completely agree because you don't have that much
exact language.
Yes, exactly. It's like it's crazy to think that you're going to have them as like a duo, but I think that that's the way you move forward. Unfortunately, because I think Stripling has been a great Swiss Army knife. So putting him in the rotation now makes me a little bit worried about who's going to be in the bullpen. But when and if Ryu comes back, I think that you have to view it as the little bit of a duo that's going to get through more innings than just Ryu himself.
Yeah, I've been calling Ryu a bigger opener for about 2 weeks, where I've just said I'm okay with Ryu as a fifth starter as an opener if he pitches well through those first three innings, and that you kind of go into the fourth with a little bit of trepidation, but that you already have somebody warming in the pen, because it's just like, I think that's where you get stuck with Ryu, is that second time through the order now. But yeah, a lot of baseball teams do this. They don't pay $20 million for it, but my case has been, it doesn't matter until the Blue Jays need that money and don't use it on someone. Because so far, the Ryu contract has not been an impediment for anything, right? Like, they've gone out and they've spent money on starting pitching since they've acquired Ryu. They've given two guys, you know, over $150 million. It's pretty impressive stuff. They went out and got George Springer. They really, really were competitive. The only guys that they haven't been in on have not been because of budgetary reasons. Like, they were never going to give Marcus Semien that contract. Like, the Dodgers lost a player. Okay, to the same team that offseason in Corey Seager, because the Rangers were throwing crazy money around. So, like, that was the David Price thing where people went, well, they didn't even offer David Price a contract. And it was like, yeah, because the contract was obscene. There was just no way of doing it. There are some that are just outside of the stratosphere. But we know that the Jays were trying to acquire Ramirez and that they got close. We know that the Jays offered Kyle Schwarber a like unbelievably competitive offer to be here. They didn't strike out in free agency this year through lack of trying or through lack of money. So I think there's two things off of Ryu. One is, can you accept that now everything is gravy? Because I don't think that, you know, you can even accept that he's an opener given his health stuff. And two is, will this team actually go out? And we overlooked at this deadline as, well, they need to add a lefty bat, lefty bat, lefty bat, lefty bat. Well, what if the one that you want isn't really there? Like, what if it is Andrew Benintendi who's the best option? And I think he's a fine baseball player, but do I really want a guy who has, you know, two home runs as my lefty slugger? I don't know. Benintendi, is it somebody that he's going to play left field, and then what's Lourdes' situation? Like, it's not as comfortable a fit with Benintendi as I think that it's been projected since the passing report on Blair's show. But the secondary one is, what if there's just some starting pitching available, and that might be a way to improve your ball club, is grabbing a rental piece who's a starting pitcher. Someone who actually does fill the Ryu role. Like, I don't know. Will that become something that's on the table? Especially if Barrios doesn't end up kind of snapping back into his like dominant self later in the year.
I think that's the big piece there. Just because, you know, obviously you got to win games to get to the playoffs. But when you look ahead to what the team looks like in the playoffs, like whoever the fifth starter is cut from the rotation anyway.
Yeah,
they're moving
totally
to the bullpen. So,
but to get there, that's what I'm saying. Like what if it's like a Matt's type where like you kind of go, hey, we want
another
have a
Stripling, basically another guy you can start and you trust coming out of the bullpen. And those guys tend to be available at similar price, probably a little more expensive than a pure bullpen arm, but not crazy expensive.
Yeah, so that's kind of where I'm at with it, is what ends up happening with the future of the fifth starter position. Because I love it when it's Ryu opener and Ross Stripling as the piggyback guy, and you get through six innings with those two, or maybe seven, and the seven is kind of the bonus inning where you go, wow, this is really an extra thing. But now you're talking about two guys who can like chew into some innings and who can do it at a pretty reasonable number for a fifth starter, like from an ERA standpoint. I don't mind it when they're healthy. I don't know if Ryu can stay healthy anymore. And if he can't get through three innings without getting hurt, like, I don't know how much you can rely on them, and I don't know how much that opens the conversation to other things. Blake, it was nice seeing you. We'll see you
in 1 hour.
We'll see you in an hour.
Yeah, my back on at 8:30. I don't know what the deal is.
You bet you are.
You can keep
doing
more
nap.
Work, Blake. You can do more work. We'll see you at 8:30 for our Wake and Rake picks. It's the Fan Morning Show. JD, Blake, and Ailish. Nice to say that one. Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
Covering the Raptors in depth like no one else. The Raptor Show with Will Liu. Subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
Fan Morning Show, Sportsnet 590 The Fan. It's JD's aux cord today. It's Friday. Vibes are high.
You know what?
You got to get that on the Spotify playlist.
I picked a little Eminem because the only reason I was thinking about Eminem is, did you see the game going on Matt Barnes' podcast? He trended for 2 days.
No, I didn't see that. Oh.
It was really lame.
Did you mean you listened to it or?
No, I saw the clips of it.
Oh, yeah.
So the game goes on, and he's doing this whole chat about how Eminem isn't played in locker rooms, and Eminem isn't played in,
really?
I think he said, the streets or clubs, which resulted in like a 48-hour beatdown of the game where it was like different athletes talking about Eminem, the different athletes being shown listening to him in the locker room, different nightclubs all around, different like views for in Detroit. Like, anyway, it was just... It was really strange, and I actually liked the game, like a lot of his songs. But yeah, it was pretty much like an all-time.
It's a weird hill to die on.
Well, it was just a really weird thing for him to go do, especially since like he's been on record in the past too of like he's an Aftermath guy, right? And so he's been on record, kind of like really, you know, the term I want to use, but I'm fighting to use it because it's the term we use. But he's kissing up to Eminem. You know, he used a different term privately in the show. But yeah, he it's like kind of sounds like the sound a chicken makes. You know, cluck,
I mean, Eminem
cluck.
Just did the Super Bowl. I think he's
No, I know.
Real
it's
hot,
just an outrageous
right? like,
thing.
He's in the, and I used to listen to. We used to listen to Eminem in the locker room,
of course,
and like
no.
I think
it's one of those things
weird.
Where...
It's so strange.
No, but it's just... It's one of those weird things where every once in a while there's like a cycle where there's like a referendum on how great was Eminem really. And then every time you go back and listen, you're like, oh, no, really, really great. Really, really great. And if you look at like the album sales and everything, it's just, yeah, he's like got 4, I think, or 5 of the top 6 selling albums of all time. It's just insane. Like he was prolific. He was one of the greatest. It's hard to have
Pretty
a run
good.
In hip hop that's like that lengthy too because it's you have to be cool in hip hop, right? And I don't think Eminem anymore, like whenever he releases stuff, you can still hear that he's a talented guy, but it's not like Eminem is still cool. Like, I don't think of him as, now I think of him as an elderly gentleman who was cool, you know? Hard to, yeah, it's hip hop too when you're like, basically, like, gotta be close to a billionaire. You said LeBron is a billionaire now?
I did see that.
You made a face like you had a thought on it, but you just said,
I did see that.
Like, you're just excited to be like,
nice
you saw it. Okay,
yeah, Eminem's net worth is $230 million. I was looking that up.
That seems light. That seems really light.
Like, yeah.
$230 million? I would have thought more.
That's it?
Anyway. Yeah. Like, I like how you and I are like, that's it? He's poor, basically.
like $230 million? Like, he's not even close to LeBron.
Yeah, he's nothing. Nothing compared to him. Anyway, I just think it is weird that in 2022... the game was using Eminem's name for clout to try to preview a new album. And then 24 hours later, after saying someone's not street enough, gets caught – or not caught, but like publishes TikTok dances. I was like, this is a tough game. This is a tough look
for
you.
It's a tough fall from grace.
I realized something on TikTok yesterday, by the way, quickly, is that if you – TikTok is basically just like if I'm doing a workout and listening to music, I think that if you just film me throughout my day, I would like unintentionally make like 8 TikToks, you know, because I'm just like listening to music.
Yeah,
I like to
pretty much just
along.
Like here's life. Yeah, here's everyone's life, just like not nothing really different. Like, here's what I made for breakfast. Like,
no, that's those one. Yeah, I can't believe anybody does. I'm proud of myself for staying off of TikTok. You know, like, you obviously.
Yeah,
no
I deleted it. Like,
things.
I deleted it. Like, I don't know, maybe 4 months ago. And
oh, look at you.
It's nice. You just.
You deleted it after Blake ruined your segment day one of doing it.
Yeah. Day one of having like trying to have something cool like Sportsnet's like get some TikTok presence, and he's like, oh yeah, I got people watching. I know what you're doing. I'm like, okay, well, that was fun. What lasted one episode?
One day, delete TikTok forever.
Here's a pretty cool thing that's happening next week. It's the RBC Canadian Open, which will be. It's already been talked about quite a lot because Dustin Johnson, who is a RBC-sponsored athlete, isn't going. But I saw this yesterday, a really cool kind of a new entryway into what golf could be in the future. When you go to a golf event, and I've been to the Canadian Open, it's kind of hard to see what's happening all over the course because you're running around, you're following one.
I can't believe you think this is cool. I'm blown away by this.
I think it's really cool.
Oh, my God.
The RBC Canadian Open is going to have something called the Skyline. Oh, I just totally lost the name. Sorry.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, you know what it is. It's 100 feet above the golf course. And so what it is, it's like a food, like a seat and a table suspended above the course where you can see the 18th hole and the first hole, and you are way up there, and 22 diners are going to be like strapped to their seats, and the structure is lifted up by this massive crane every 30 minutes, and you get to go in there and eat and drink, and then you disembark and a new group of people go in. So it's like basically like kind of like a fair ride that you get to watch the game from a different perspective. I know it's a little bit silly and different, but
it's the worst idea in the history of golf.
Honest to God,
I was irrationally embarrassed by this. Like, this is embarrassing. Mm-hmm. At the Canadian Open, one of the worst things that they do is they keep trying to do this thing of like, we're Canada, hey, we got hockey up here. We got, hey guys, we got slap shots, and it's at the Canadian Open, and
how
just
does
play
that
golf.
Have to do with this?
I'm saying that we try to do some type of gimmicky events that make us feel second rate a little bit in the golf world. And you look at this, hanging people by a crane to eat. Who wants to drink and watch? Golf is supposed to be about going. I think golf is exclusionary for a lot of people, that people feel like it's too much of a country club atmosphere. And I'll hear you on some of these things.
Usually at a country club.
Yeah, guess what? This is at St. George's. I don't want to go to one of the world's classiest golf courses, the country's classiest golf course, hang from a crane and eat soup. Like, what? The first gust of wind, you're going to feel like such a bozo up there. Honest to God, that, like, this is Instagram culture gone
wrong. I
want to
do it. I want to go.
Because
you
want to post. Because you're a...
No, I want to experience what it's like and be up there.
You want to experience what it's like?
I'm sure there's going to be... things
no,
that kind
trash.
Of go wrong, and you're going to be like, how we strap to our chairs while we eat dinner? There's going to be some interesting stories coming out of it. So
no, there won't
I'm
be any interesting stories. It'll be trash. I'm not surprised. You shouldn't be surprised at all. I talked about this with our good buddy Sam McKee for like 30 minutes 2 days ago.
Does he hate
when
it
I first
too?
Saw Yes, because it's disgusting. It's actually embarrassing.
It's
disgusting. It's so embarrassing. You're going to bring a crane to St. George's and hang people off of a little kind of like crappy restaurant thing in the sky. And I cannot believe that they came up with this idea and that anybody thought it was good and that they greenlit it. And to me, again, it's like you like it because you're like in your condo and you've got your balcony view and you go, snapping it, putting it on Insta. Exactly. And it's like anybody who goes up there is only doing it for the gram. You're doing it for the gram, and that's fine. Just admit that's what you're doing it for the gram, all right? Anybody that goes up there, golf, you're not going to golf to see top view. Oh, wow.
It's only 30 minutes. You don't watch the whole day up there.
Lame.
You go up, you see it, and you go back down, and you follow whoever you want to follow. All right. Other stories coming out of the RBC.
You think that's better than
Canadian
just
Open?
Walking the course?
Like, no, I don't think it's better. I think it's an intriguing 30-minute experience that I would be interested in. Okay,
you go
so
up there,
DJ...
it'll be windy and cold, and you're blowing around, and you're going, what an interesting experience this is for me sitting in the... You think the views are going to be immaculate?
So I want to live my life and try new things, okay?
Yeah, okay, fine. Yeah.
Okay, so Dustin Johnson obviously not going to be at the RBC Canadian Open because he's joining the Saudi-backed league, which is something he said he wasn't going to do in February, but he got handed a fat $125 million check just to show up. He's going to be one of 16 of the top 100 ranked players that are going to go to this tournament. It's interesting because he lost his big sponsor, RBC, and he was going to headline the event. And now they're like, oh, boy, what are we going to do? But he said he was fully committed to the PGA Tour back in February, but now saying that this is the best move for his family. Well, yeah, you think $125 million?
I wish Vic was still here to do the my family drop.
My family, because
this is just outrageous. Your family includes the daughter of the great one. And you're,
yeah, you got it.
You got it. So the drops, we'd go Josh. Dustin Johnson. He's not a poor man. He's already got $200 million in career earnings. $200 million. He's got M&M money. Okay. And all he's ever done is golf. And like Eminem, he's like, I'm one of the greatest artists of all time. What have you done? This guy's like, I golf. He goes, I'm the same as you. It's the same. That's how much money is on the – like, this is so stupid. This is some – like one of the dumbest things ever. Like, this is just greed to the max. Like, this is greed to the max. You're all these guys. I don't know. Okay, I've always done this thing of how could you really, when people have a favorite golfer, I'm like, ugh, okay, like it's your favorite golfer. All right, fine. If that's the guys you kind of want to align, not that it's the whole athletes, role models things, but golf is kind of a different story. And these guys are just completely in their own world. Like they're literally living in a country club. Whenever we've seen the old movies about like, oh, this person who's disconnected from reality, it's like they're. Every golfer that you love is the villain in Caddyshack. Like, you do realize that, right? Like, they're all that guy. That none of them are Dangerfield. Like, they're all the old guy. That's who they are. Every one of them. They're no different. They're all the same. And golf fans are always like, no, this guy's cool. It's like, no, he's not. He stinks. He's the same as the rest of these guys. Sorry, they're all the same dude. And yeah,
I just wonder how their legacies are all going to – all these guys that are jumping ship, I wonder how their legacies will be changed because of this.
They say they're changed, and Phil's is the worst because Phil's the guy that like is going to bear the brunt of it because he was like America's – he went from being a villain to America's sweetheart, all the up and down thing. But and he also said the things out loud. But at least he did. Like, just Dustin Johnson's going here like, it's good for my family and this will be a cool experience. Like, shut up, man. You're going to horrible, horrible, horrible place that's doing horrible, horrible, horrible things. And you're ignoring it all for money. You're like the ultimate sellout where you already have it. This isn't a family consideration. Anyway, it's awful. I hate it. It stinks. It's not going to affect their legacies, though, because golf people will forgive him whenever he wants to come back and they'll ignore it. And because that's what you do at country clubs is like you don't bring up the awfulness. You speak of it in quiet
corners.
And the
PGA was saying that they weren't even going to be able to come back and they've backed up on that saying they'll just, you know, handle, they'll have fines and stuff. Like they're scared to lose
fines.
These guys.
Oh, yeah.
So.
DJ's going to be really scared of the fine after he gets $100 million from the
he's getting $125 million. So I don't think he'll care about the fines. We're going to take a break and talk to Dan Shulman after your Blue Jays red hot. That's next on the Fan Morning Show. Sportsnet 590 The Fan.